This is an interview with Harold Schramm by Darlene Weibel for the Oral History Department of Youngstown State University on Monday, November 15th, 1991 at 4:15 o'clock p.m. at 275 Federal Plaza West, Youngstown, Ohio, 44501. Harold, I'd like to ask you where you were born and where you were raised.
I was born in Valero, Ohio, August 29, 1946. But I grew up in Salem, Ohio. We lived there when I was about 5 years old.
About five. Bel Air, very far from Salem?
80 miles. It's down the river.
Mm-hmm. And you lived in Salem then for the rest of your life? And you're still there now. Did you travel much when you were growing up?
No. Same town, same house. Other than vacation.
You took a yearly vacation with your family?
We tried to, but it wasn't. I actually went to Washington. Had a sister in Chicago. We get to travel around a little bit.
But not that much. You were basically a hometown boy.
Small town, hometown boy.
And stayed around the area most of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me something about your growing up years.
I don't think there were anything remarkable. I would have called us poor, but I think the truth is lower middle class. I was the youngest of five, and three older sisters and an older brother. And I think it's a pretty normal childhood. Had some fun, and got into some trouble, but nothing serious.
Did you live in the city or more in the country?
In the city.
In the city.
Mm-hmm. I was what the parents were might describe as a morning.
You still are. Tell me about your school day. Did you go to college right after high school?
No, I graduated from high school, and because, again, we were poor, I went immediately to work, got a job at the Salem News, right out of high school, and was waiting for the draft. So at that point, I graduated in June of 65, and that was just at the peak of build-up. Everyone who didn't go to college knew you were going to draft. What you did then, graduate from high school and join the Army, or you graduated from high school and went to college, if you wanted to take your chances, you just sat around and waited until the draft got to you. The draft got
to you. When did it get you?
I graduated in June, and I got my physical notice in, like, October. I drafted the first day of September, which I think is also interesting as a sign of the time, in that you couldn't sit around for more than a few months and make drafts.
That's true. So you left just before Christmas?
Mm-hmm. And that was also strange. Said goodbye to everybody. I had a girlfriend, who was my wife at the time, but now, because she was a girlfriend then. Said goodbye to my parents, goodbye to her, and left for Fort Knox, 1st of December, and I was home by the 21st. 3 weeks later, they gave us Christmas leave.
Did they really?
Yeah, that's crazy.
From basic training?
Yeah, right in the middle of basic training, they sent us home.
I never heard of that.
I bizarre, strange.
So you were drafted into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And did you go first, right from basic to Vietnam, or did you do other things?
Well, they have what they call advanced training. If you were combat, they have advanced combat training. I went to what they call transportation school. And I was trained to be a parts specialist for light helicopters. And sounded like very useful. What they call MOS, military occupation. But typical Army fashion, that's not what I did. When I got over to Vietnam after advanced training, they assigned me to a stevedore-type company, which was overseeing the unloading of ships.
Big difference.
Well, but see, the Army didn't think so. Transportation's transportation, see. But it always bothered me a little bit. I was the honor graduate of my class.
Were you?
And I went to Fort Eustis, Virginia. We call it Fort Eustis. Was trained as a parts specialist. Honor graduate of my class. Never worked in a supply. Never touched a light helicopter part. Did nothing whatsoever to do with helicopters. But anyway, chronologically, I think it's interesting. I got drafted 1st of December, graduated from basic training February 5th, 66. Went to Fort Eustis, Virginia, after basic, got about 2 weeks. And got my orders from Vietnam in April.
That
and
quick.
Was in Vietnam the first day of May.
Really?
Yeah, so, like I say, I got drafted in December, went through basic, which took about 2 to 3 months, and that was another thing, they accelerated that. That's supposed to be a 12-week thing. We were going night and day for training. They were rushing, again, with a tremendous buildup, and they were just processing and moving people. So I went to advanced training for about 6 weeks, took a leave before I went to Vietnam, got married.
Did you get married before you went?
And left all within the span of, like, 5 months?
5 months, yeah. I had no idea that it went that way for you.
You know, they were just burning them, just pushing mm-hmm. to get the people over.
Well, I wanted to ask you what your basic training was like and when you got your orders, and they just seemed to coincide.
Well, basic training, I don't know. I guess it's one of those love-hate things.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in middle America, small town. My father was not in the military, okay? He was too old. He had too many kids when World War II broke out. But all his brothers and all my uncles and all the older people that we knew, all the men served in the military.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we were poor,
mm-hmm.
okay? We weren't poor white trash, what they call it today, but we weren't anywhere near middle class, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Scraped your whole way along. And it wasn't just true for my dad and his family, you know, mm-hmm. just for my mother's family. Everybody we knew, we were all middle class, struggling like hell, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But all his brothers served. I was named after an uncle who was killed in World War II. He was still 44. I was born 46. And we had this tradition of service. Okay? And I just knew that when my turn came, I would serve, and gladly and proudly. So. But that was a strange war. You know, the protests had not yet come on real strong in 65 and 66 when I first went in. And the Army was a love-hate thing. I mean, I loved some of the things that we did, you know, but they were so stupid. I mean, some of the orders, some of the things that you had to do in the military was just reading. Makes you wonder how we could ever win a war with people like that in charge. But basically, I was proud to serve, and I did the best I could. Though I was miserable, homesick.
Were you?
No.
I wanted to ask you how it felt being away from home for the first time. I mean, even though you went on vacation.
Yeah, but never left the family.
Family.
Never
right.
went anywhere without someone, mm-hmm. a mother, a father, you know, someone.
in a complete different area. I mean, Kentucky, Virginia are so different from our area.
Well, like I said, just a sense of wonder, you know, amazed, and I just couldn't imagine. But, you know, I adapted well, but I would have loved to have seen myself. If I could go back now and look at this bumpkin, you know, running around doing what he was called bumpkin. But something in there, I'm sorry, was all I could imagine about basic. Yeah, basic training, I want to say it was a joke, okay? But I don't know. Typical military, just an example. I am a good shot with a rifle. My father and my family were all hunters, and we've all been, we've done firearms since we were small and trained to handle them safely and wisely. I was totally familiar with firearms. Went through basic training, listened to what they told me, did what they told me, shot well. Came to the day before we had to fire for record, for official designation, and my rifle broke, the sight broke on me. They repaired it, but the setting was totally different than what I had. Normally, you'd set your rifle up, you have to go up 20 clicks, and 20 clicks to the right, and that adjustment would make your rifle shoot perfectly at that set distance. Okay, that was fine. Well, the morning of record fire, I got up, and it says in the new setting, which was 20 clicks up to the right and 30 to the left, I went back and did the old just a dumbass mistake. So I shot the record, and the only targets I could hit were the very close ones. They'd pop up, shoot them, they'd fall back down. But anything beyond, like I was like 30 yards away, not very far. Anything out 100 yards, 150, 200, 300 yards, I missed completely. And I was just frustrated. I couldn't understand. Now, when I got back to the barracks, I said to myself, I said, well, what in the world is going on? And then I realized what I had done, that I had set the wrong setting. And the rifle was only shooting where I had set it to shoot, which was nowhere near what it was supposed to shoot. So I went to the sergeant, and I explained to him what I'd done. He told me that if I failed, 2 day shoot, first day and second day. If I failed the second day, I would have to go back to the very beginning of basic training and start all over again. So that we were like 6 or 8 weeks down the road now, you know.
Just for a
small
mistake.
Well, it was a small mistake, but it was a mistake, and it was my mistake. And this man told me that if I failed to qualify on the second day, that I would have to go back to the beginning and start all over. Well, the first day we shot like 80 targets, and I missed maybe 70 of them, okay? The second day we were only shooting like 40 targets, but to qualify, I'd have to hit maybe 35 of the 40 to get a score low enough just to qualify. Well, needless to say, the next day I went out, I shot my ass off. I hit 39 out of 40 or something. Qualified, but barely, just barely qualified. Some of my friends, people I went in with, made friends with, failed to qualify day one, failed to qualify day two. So of course they had to go. Now, every day for the next 2 weeks, they went to the range and shot all over again until they qualified. They never had to go back. They never had to try it again. Now, I was so mad because my father and my brother and my uncles wanted to know how I did at the rifle range. And I got the lowest rating there was, a marksman. And I should have shot expert as I wanted to and did the second day. But the bastards lied to me. And they did that all through the military. Every time you got faced with a situation, somebody would lie to you. So you would do something stupid, or you would worry, or you would fret, or, you know. And pissed me off. Now, it occurs to me But a couple of guys in my company who did shoot expert all went infantry.
Did they really?
Well, they had no choice. They were assigned. So now I sit back and I wonder, my pride was hurt and I wanted to shoot expert, but had I shot expert, maybe I would have been assigned to a to an infantry company rather than a transportation outfit.
That's right.
And got my butt blown off. So I don't know. Things work out and then I wanted to work out.
Mm-hmm. That's true, indeed.
But that's been my experience with the military, is that they lie.
When you got assigned to Vietnam, where did you go?
Consonoot Air Base, which was just outside of Saigon. I lived out there in a tent for about 2 weeks. And then they transferred me into the 4th Transportation Command, headquarters company, downtown Saigon. And we lived at the Li Lai Hotel. It's a hotel built in Vietnam. Military rented it or took it over, turned it into a barracks. It was barbed wire and what looks like a baseball backstop to you, but that hurricane chain link fence clear up to the second floor.
Really?
Well, you couldn't throw a hand grenade up that high. And then it had sandbags and placements and all that. But I lived in this hotel for the whole year.
You were here a year?
1 year.
1 year.
And it was tough.
Oh, yes.
The first, when we first got there, there was 2 men to a room. Mm-hmm. And we had the regular hotel furniture, which is beds, dressers, you know, just like any cheap hotel anyway. Everybody had their own mama son, which was an old woman who, for a couple of bucks a month, would clean the room, make your bed, and shine your sheets.
Really?
And it was pretty tough. After about 3 months, they doubled the population of the hotel. We had to get rid of the hotel furniture because there wasn't room for it. They put in GI bunks and foot lockers. And it wasn't quite as good then. Now we have 4 guys to a room. We worked, there was 2 shifts. There was a day shift that worked 6 to 6 and a night shift that worked 6 to 6. And there was
12-hour
day. That's all you worked. And you got 1 day off every 10. And then after few months, we got about 1 day off, generally Sunday, but we got off. But I get up in the morning, shower and get dressed, run out front of the hotel, catch a bus.
A bus?
The bus would take us to another hotel that had a restaurant. Our hotel didn't have a restaurant. And we'd go in and order breakfast. Breakfast was 50 cents. You could get anything you wanted to eat, as much as you wanted.
Is this military food?
Military food. Mm-hmm. But again, they used Vietnamese civilians whenever they could. Mm-hmm. So they had civilian cooks and waiters and waitresses. And it was just like a hotel restaurant. So we ate there every day. And then we had to go to work. Now, I worked in an office with an American captain and a Vietnamese man and 6 Vietnamese girls. Our job was to check the bills of lading, which is the manifest from the ship, all the cargo, compare that to the bills that we'd received from the Vietnamese stevedore companies. They would bill us so many hours, so many men for unloading all this equipment. We were to match those and then approve the bills for payment if we felt that the charges they billed us for were reasonable. It was a joke. I had the slightest idea of what the hell, how many men it takes to unload a tank.
And how would you know just by a piece of paper what was actually on the ship?
Well, we had the manifest. That was our ship. It was supposed to be there. They'd bill us. But most of these stevedore companies were owned by Frenchmen living in Vietnam. And they had Vietnamese labor and work. Originally, when I got first assigned to this, my job was a cargo checker. I'd have to stand out there on the ship, and as the items came off, I would check them off on the list. Well, hell, it's 110 in the shade out there. It's just very poor working conditions. And I was out there about a week, and I ran into a lieutenant. I was a private at the time. His name was Lutzenheiser. And I said, "Sir, excuse me, but I grew up next door to a Lutzenheiser from Ohio." He Where?
I said, say it. He said,
Uncle Dick.
He was from Youngstown.
Really?
And so we had a reunion of sorts. And he said, he explained to me that I was much too smart to be staying out here in the sun, that he ought to get me inside in the office. And that's all I got that from the man.
Really?
So saying that's the other thing I found out about the Army, is you have to know somebody, and somebody has to like, sort of like it is here. Okay.
You got it.
So I did that for a whole year.
You were there 1 year? 1 year.
I left California on the 30th day of April, landed in Saigon on the 2nd day of May. They still owe me May the 1st, 1966. I never lived that day. When I crossed the date line, I guess they think they paid it back. Like, I left there April 27th in the afternoon and landed the morning of the same day back in this district.
Yeah.
How that worked.
No early out for you.
Well, they offered me a move. What they did, the Army said if I would extend my tour for 3 months, they would give me an early out plus 30 days leave. Plus, I was an E-4 time, they'd make me an E-5. If you're saying grade of sergeant, I don't know, that's what they call specialist spot. But by this time, I didn't trust the Army. After I went home, spent a few weeks with my wife and family, then I had to go back to Fort Knox for the next 6 months to finish out my 2 years.
Me too.
And I wish that I agreed to stay in Vietnam for another 6 months. I just didn't trust them. When I was at Fort Knox, living down there in a trailer park with my wife, a couple of things happened. One, my first day back from overseas, came back, spent some time at home with my wife, reported for duty, walked in to the ready room where the first sergeant sat in the company clerk, reported for duty. Now, I was an E-4, which is no big deal. The same as a corporal. I had almost a year in grade, so I was an E-4 with grade. I'm back from Vietnam. I spent my time. I walked into the room, reported, and the company clerk said, First Sergeant, here's a man for KP. And they put me on KP my very first day back into active service. Now, that was a dirty deal, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. Yeah, every couple of months, your name came up on the roster that you had to pull KP, which is a dirty grudge. Waiting on other people. You had to be there at 6, but if you got there at 6, you got the dirtiest job of all, which was punching paint. So what happened was guys just started going in at 2 or 3 in the morning so they could be the dining room orderly, which all he had to do was wait on the officers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bull, I'm not getting up at 2 in the morning to kiss anybody. So I always got punched.
What were you doing?
Well, but you stay in the back. Nobody bothers you, you just work, and they let you go about 7 or 8 that night, you know, after working like a slave, and then you were off the hook for a couple of months. Well, anyway, I was scheduled for KP like on Wednesday, and I knew it. I lived off post in the trailer with my wife, which cost $110 a month. My paycheck at the time was $110.03. Bonnie got a check for $140 with my allowance plus what the government. We lived on $140 a month. But anyway, I reported Wednesday morning for KP, and they sent me to the first sergeant because I was AWOL. I was absent without leave. And I was waiting to see the captain, and I couldn't figure out how or why they had me as AWOL. So I went and see the captain. He said, well, the Tram, where were you yesterday? I said, I was at work, doing my Army job. I said, you had KP yesterday. He said, no, sir, I had KP today. I'm here. No. Smith or Jones or somebody got sick. Your name was moved up. He said, and I said, well, I read the bulletin board Monday and saw that KP on Wednesday, and He said, is there a standing order that you're to read the bulletin board every day? I said, yes, sir. $32 fine, which is like a third of my pay. 2 weeks extra duty, which meant KP every day. 2 weeks assigned, restricted to quarters.
So that means you couldn't go home to your wife?
I said, sir, I live off base. He said, all right, stay in your yard.
No.
Yes. I mean, unbelievable. Just unbelievable. So for cause of that, I didn't get a good conduct, which everybody gets if they don't get in trouble. But I got an Article 15, a misdemeanor in the Army.
Sure, that's unreal.
I don't know who's going to listen to this, but all they do is fuck constantly.
One of my questions was, what major events stand out during this
time? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Army. How they mess with you. Unbelievable how they mess with you.
On a daily basis. When you were in Vietnam, what images of home did you carry with you?
I had pictures of my wife. She wrote me every day, which was real nice. She'd number the letters, starting off 365, and was working her way down. I think number one actually got to me after I was back home. But that was real nice. Of course, we were new. We got married, and about 10 days after we got married, I shipped out. But that was nice. And this is how selfish children are when you think about it. I wanted, Bonnie and I were high school sweethearts, fine. If something happened to me, I would like her to have that GI insurance, which is $10,000. Totally ignoring my parents, who had raised me, given me everything that they had, and what was I thinking of? I mean, the hell with them. I was giving it all to this little girl who they didn't know from Adam. I mean, I don't know why I thought that was such a noble thing. But back then, people didn't live together. At least not in my small town, not in my family. So we got married because that was the only way we could see to spend those last few days together and night. But we're still married, so I guess. What was the question?
What images of home did you carry with you when you were there?
Parents, I don't know what happens when you turn 15, 16, 17. I mean, you don't really care about your parents. My mother wrote to me, I'd write back, and the Red Cross called me and said to write. Now, I wasn't much of a letter writer, but I did write to my wife quite often, not quite every day.
Did you think about your room or your house? Hometown.
Yeah, Mom was real good, and so was Bonnie, about keeping me informed of what was going on. One of the strangest, bizarre, you'll love this one, bizarre things that happened. There was a kid that I had grown up with named Larry Crumbaker. Larry was a year older than me, but we were in Sunday school class together. We were in Boy Scouts together. We shared a tent at summer camp. His dad was the camp. Nice kid, real nice, quiet, shy. He joined the Marines. Why, I'll never know. He was not your typical gung-ho type Marine kid.
Was he drafted and joined after he drafted
I
or
think
enlisted?
He joined up. I'm pretty sure he joined. Well, any event, I had lost track of Larry, but I knew he was in the service. I'm sitting in a snack bar, I guess you would call it, in Saigon. Got a letter from my wife, got a letter from home. So I read the letter from my wife, opened up the letter from home, and out fell a newspaper clip. Opened it up, and it's Larry's picture. He'd been killed in action about 2 weeks earlier. Now, it's always bothered me that Larry and I were in the same country, a few hundred miles apart, probably. He was up north of the Marines, I was down south of the Army. He died. That news went all the way back to Salem, Ohio, and then had to come all the way back to Vietnam for me to find out. And it was very—it was only about 2 weeks before I left to come home. And the first, not the first day back, but the very second or third day back, I went to church with my family, and the first guy I ran into was Larry's dad. you got drafted. I think you were, and I think his mother had committed suicide a year or so before.
Safe?
Oh yeah, yeah. That was early on. And Saigon is a beautiful city. And people, I like to get these people. I really did. But it was a beautiful city. And the war had not. The night of Tet. That's what everyone talks about. Tet. So you're talking about Tet, 1967. I was chief Q of the guards, commander of the guard, the night of Tet, 1966. And my job, and that was quite a feat for me because I hardly got to do anything more than one. I was commander of the guard that night. And it always occurred to me that through good fortune or whatever, if I'd have gone to college for 1 year and got in there 1 year later, I'd have been commander of the guard, perhaps the night of Tet 67, and got my ass wiped, because that was a very bad night. I missed that by an entire year. That was another thing. Talk about the Army. When we pulled guard right there at the Lehigh Hotel, and then we also had to pull guard at an officer's DOQ, which is an officer, bachelor officer's quarters. So they'd put us in a Jeep, they would drive us 2-3 miles out in the suburbs of Saigon, and it was our job for 2 hours to walk up and down on the sidewalk in front of this BOQ with a weapon. You were allowed to have a clip of ammunition in the weapon, but you weren't allowed to have a shell in the chamber. So in other words, you couldn't shoot anybody quickly if you had to. But you had ammunition, if you really needed it, you could load your weapon with it. So it occurred to me, when you're walking guard at 2 o'clock in the morning, that what the hell am I doing here? There's absolutely nothing I can do, you know. And then I realized that the only thing I could do was get killed. And perhaps if the officers inside heard me go down, they could then run out the back door, because I sure as hell couldn't have done that. I mean, it was so pathetic and so ridiculous. But there again, that's the Army's mentality. You know, maybe one, better sacrifice one private than maybe, you know, a dozen officers.
Now, would they come and check your weapon to be sure there wasn't something in the chamber?
Yeah.
They would?
Oh, yeah. They were always screwing. Yeah, that's part of going on and off duty. You had to present your weapon. Typical Army. They blew up a hotel right around the corner from us. It was an Air Force hotel. They put a bomb on the roof and blew the top 3 or 4 floors right down to the bomb, killed about 11 guys. Every once in a while, a rocket would come in, or a mortar attack would come in. We could watch the war. Okay, at night, we used to show movies on top of our hotel. We had built like a drive-in theater type of thing with a screen and benches on the roof. Yeah. And tropical country, beautiful country, but hotter than hell during the day. Nights were very pleasant. So we'd go up on the roof and they'd show a movie. Usually Class B, Grade B movies. You wouldn't even catch on the Late, Late, Late show here, but at least it was something to do. But the war would often interfere. They had something they called Pop the Magic Dragon, which was a C-130. Electric machine guns, mini guns on it, and they'd fly out not too far from us, drop a few flares, and then they'd hose down the countryside with machine guns on it. or they call in dive bombers sometimes. So we shut the movie off and go watch the war, okay? Because it was more interesting than the movie. And those attacks would last a half an hour or so, and then you know, the players would go out and the planes would fly away.
Go back and watch the movie.
The other thing I think is fair to point out is that my first 3 months in Vietnam, I nearly became an alcoholic. We'd get off work, we'd work 6 to 6, we'd been on work for 12 hours. We'd get off work, curfew was at 11, so you had to be in your hotel or barracks or wherever you were assigned, and off the street. Everyone had to be off the street at 11. So we had about 5 hours to kill them. So we'd go to one of these hotels and order dinner. Now dinner cost $2, so it's rather expensive. But again, you had the choice of whatever was on the menu. Not exactly that. They'd have two or three ice cubes. Food wasn't very good. We would eat, and then we'd go into the bar. Beer was 10 cents. Mixed drinks were 20 cents. Well, what we would do is, three or four or five of us, we would just slip the little Vietnamese barmaid a buck and tell her to bring us 5 screwdrivers. The reason being there, the orange juice and vodka is about the only thing they couldn't screw up. Okay? So she'd bring a tray with perhaps 25 drinks on it, staggering under the weight of the tray, and sit it down there. We'd sit there and just proceed to get totally shit faced every night. Every night. And eventually I came to my senses and quit. But I suspect there are a lot of guys out there wandering around today who still have a problem. And I'll say something else while we're talking about too. Cigarettes were 11 cents a pack.
So it was
donated, I suspect, by the tobacco company. Well, we were rationed to 6 cartons a month. That's all you were allowed to buy. That's a hell of a lot of cigarettes. So for $6.60, I could buy enough tobacco to give myself cancer. As it turned out, I gave myself a heart attack when I was 35 and was thoroughly and totally hooked on cigarettes by the time I left Vietnam.
And you never smoked before you went?
I started smoking in the Army, bam, back to the Army again, okay? These people, I love them. Anyone in this room smoke? Okay, you men that smoke, go take a 10-minute break. The rest of you just keep working. Oh, shit! I'm a smoker, man. Let me out of here. You know. Hey.
I guess so.
Every hour you get a 10-minute break. So what the hell? I'm going to smoke. Damn right I'm going to smoke. No. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
That's commendable that you pulled yourself together and knew enough not to keep doing it.
Well, I don't think I could. Physically, I don't think I could have kept it. I mean, booze was cheap, food was cheap, everything was cheap. I lived in the hotel expense-free. I got my Army pay, I got overseas pay, I got combat pay, and because we ate and lived in hotels, I got cost of living pay. I was pulling down 3 times my normal salary. My wife, who knew what I made, I started sending home like $100 or $150 or even sometimes $200 a month.
That's a lot of money.
And back then that was a tremendous amount of money. You need me? Okay. That was a tremendous amount of money. I think when I got back from Vietnam we had $2,000 in the bank. I don't think we have $2,000 in the bank today. But back then you could have bought a new car for $2,000. That was 1966, 67, I know. That was a hell of a lot of money. But then, like I say, I quit drinking to excess. Women were another problem. I was recently married, so I was okay, true blue and straight arrow. But you could get a prostitute for $2, what they call it, short time. You could get a girl all night for $15.
Long time.
Long time. You could get anything you wanted. There was nothing that you could not buy. Drugs I didn't know anything. We're talking punk kid hick from Ohio. I knew nothing but marijuana and hashish and opium they sold on the street. The Vietnamese people didn't care much about what I would call a sicklo driver. This is a, you'd think of a guy as a rickshaw. Well, these guys had bicycles with seats attached, right? And they would call them sicklo. And they, you know, for 50 cents, they'd pedal your butt all over town. Well, these guys would, tremendous pain in the legs, I can just tell, you know, cramps. They'd stop and at a little sidewalk thing and buy a little thing of hashish or opium, smoke it, get back on their thing and pedal on. You know, this is how they survive. This is how they live. But drugs were common. Drugs were readily available. The big city kids knew all about them. We didn't know anything. But Army, 3 o'clock in the morning, they'd come in and have a raid on your room.
Really?
Dump your footlocker out, tear all your stuff apart, looking for drugs. Now, if you had drugs, of course, you understood that. But it was just harassment. That's all it was. So just plain ordinary harassment.
That's surprising. I thought maybe they'd be more lenient over there. Or, you know, leave you alone a little bit more. But they didn't.
Well, you would think so. My wife, on our honeymoon, bought me a pocket knife. Rather a large, probably about 3 inches long. Had a little leather case. And I was going into Vietnam, a combat zone, and I wanted a knife. The first day in Vietnam, they took it off and made me put it in the weapons room. I didn't see it again until my last day.
And they gave it back.
Then they gave it back. I love the Army. I love the Army.
I can tell. Harold, the images that you took with you, you know, to Vietnam and you thought about and kept you going, when you came home, how were they different from what you, you know, had imagined them to be and sort of how you didn't really expect them to change, but how did they change?
Not as much as you might. I can see where the question is, mm-hmm. is pointing, but no, I didn't have a lot of problems. The only thing that stuck in my mind as a real surprise when I got back was how much my father had aged.
Really?
Whether I had never looked at him, and I don't know that I ever did. He never looked at your dad. But when I got off the plane and landed in Pittsburgh, and Bonnie and my mother and father were waiting for me, my dad looked old.
Mm-hmm.
Now at that time, he must have been around 50. I was in jail. And not old, but he looked old. He looked gray. He looked old. When I went away, I was a kid, and he was my dad. Okay, so I guess when I came back, you know, I'm the man, and he's the old man. But that bothered me. After I came back, okay, I had a problem in that. I was still under the impression, in my mind, that I had done a good thing. I thought, as my father and his brothers would have, World War II, you got called, you served, you did the best you could, you put up with the shit, you did what they asked you. It was an honorable thing that you had done. Then the trouble started, because my friends, most of whom were still in college, they weren't exactly calling me baby killers and all, but let's face it, they were totally opposed to the war. The media was totally opposed to the war, okay? It became a very difficult situation then, because you thought you'd done an honorable thing, you thought you'd done the best you could. If in fact it was a dishonorable war, if in fact it was wrong, you could take any position you want, but you either were a fool, you know, they had fooled you, tricked you into serving in a dishonorable cause. Or you could have gone completely overboard and dropped on their side, say, yes, it was bad. That's, remember the movie Born on the 4th of July with Ron Kovic? Okay. Ron Kovic and I were exactly the same. When I was a kid, I played on it, and I wanted to serve. I was gung-ho. I was him, and I grew up. But he got shot, and he got paralyzed, and it embittered him, and he was then totally opposed to the war. I'm not. I still think the war was an honorable thing. We were trying to do the right thing. We didn't do a very good job at it. We didn't sell the public before we fought the war, but they did an admirable job in Desert Storm. They sold the war, okay, and then they had the troops go in. But we did it the other way, and it didn't work out well. But Ron Kovic lost his faith. See, now he's very bitter. But I don't know how much of that had to do with the war or the fact that he was paralyzed. But I don't know. But in the beginning of that movie, I recognize myself. That's the kind of kid I was. You know, we were all going to grow up and join the army and go kill the bad guys. But he lost his faith. I never did lose mine, but it was awfully tough for a long time. And what happened was you just simply didn't talk to me about that. Where you been? I used to say, well, I was in the Army. I said, oh, hell, I don't say that anymore.
Really?
Yeah, I was away. You know, where you been? Oh, just around. You know,
evaded everything.
Yeah, there's no point in talking about it because if he was a hawk, which we call a hawk, we were fighting the war all wrong. If they were anti-war, then we were all baby killers and you know, worse than the scum of the earth. So there was just no way, you couldn't talk to anybody about it. So you didn't talk to anybody. I had nothing to cry about. I mean, I hadn't been in combat. I hadn't been shot. I hadn't been killed. You know, they took a year of my life. There's that stigma that we lost the war. And I don't think that's true. So the Vietnamese, to give them credit, you know, they're good people, even the North Vietnamese. They turned out to be much better fighters and much more dedicated than the South Vietnamese. But I honestly believe we could have won that war. Because we never lost any battles. How in the hell can you lose a war when you never lost any battles? Well, I suspect we lost the war on the 6 o'clock news with Walter Cronkite. After Tet, Walter, who was a bit of a hawk, turned the other way. He thought, well, now we can't win this war. And we kicked their asses at Tet. We kicked their asses all over the country. But in our minds, in the minds of the American people, we have lost. And once that feeling, I don't know if you've ever been in a fist fight or in a fight, but when you think you've lost, you have. Okay, it's over, you know, and no matter what happens from that point on. So at some point there, you know, we lost the war. And it was such a shame because it was such a sacrifice, you know.
Very, very.
Tremendous sacrifice. And we're still paying. We're still paying today.
How did you adapt to the changes, and what methods did you use and found successful in your adaptations?
After I came back.
Mm-hmm. After you
came back.
Avoidance.
That was okay. Again, see, mm-hmm. I have no, I didn't kill any babies. I didn't see my best friend blown up. I didn't get shot at and crap my pants. I mean, none of these things happened to me. So there are veterans organizations out there now. Vietnam Veterans of Columbia County. I've never been to one of their meetings, and I'm never going to go to one of them because I don't feel that my sacrifice was worthy of any special note. Okay, there was probably about 3 or 4 million guys served in that war. 60,000 got killed. That's terrible, but that's not very many. And another 500,000 probably got wounded. Okay. I heard a story, and it's not my original idea, but it's like there's like an onion, perhaps. There's all these different layers, okay? The guys who never served in the military feel guilty.
That's
because
true.
They feel like they ducked something, okay? The guys that served in the military but didn't go to Vietnam feel guilty, okay? The guys that went to Vietnam but didn't serve in combat feel guilty. Okay? The guys that served in combat but never got wounded feel guilty. The guys that were wounded and didn't get killed, they feel guilty. So apparently the only ones who are happy are the poor dead sons of bitches on the wall. I don't know. I mean,
I know people like that. That's a real good point.
That's, I say, everybody feels guilty except the guys who don't, and they wish the hell they could come back and feel guilty, I'm sure. So, I mean, it's just like, you know, unless you got killed, you didn't do your best or something. I don't know.
It's an unusual phenomenon, but it's a reality.
But see, everybody you talk to, I feel bad. I didn't serve in combat. I'm not a crazy Vietnam vet. But you talk to a crazy Vietnam vet, and he knows he feels guilty about something. You talk to guys who were in the Air Force. I have a buddy who spent 4 years in the Air Force, 1965 to 1969, in Columbus, Ohio.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, what a sacrifice. When the state of Ohio passed the Vietnam Veterans Bonus, he got more money than I did.
Did he really?
He got $10 a month for every month of service, so he got $480. I got $20 a month for every month in Vietnam, and $10 a month for every month in service. So I got like $360. I mean, this guy worked for JCPenney's full time while he was in the Air Force. He had enough off-duty time that he could do his Air Force job and work full time for Penney's. I mean, he made a mint working in Columbus for the Air Force, serving his country for 4 years. What an idiot. Why couldn't I have done something smart like that? I don't know. Some people just fall in.
That's true. There's some areas of the...
And he's a big deal with Farmore now. Would you like to interview
really?
Him? Jeez. He doesn't even remember his Air Force career. All he can remember is working for Penny.
Really?
And fooling around with the co-eds down on campus.
Out at Rickenbacker.
Yeah.
Jeez. That's,
isn't that?
That's amazing. That really is. That was a good one. I needed
anyway,
that.
You say, how did I handle?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The changes. But really, it seems like your father was the only shock.
My mother blames my lack of strong religious feelings now to Vietnam. She says I lost that over there. I don't know if I lost that over there or not, but I just don't attend church now and was raised in a very strong. Perhaps she's compensating because if I had to, if she pressed me, I'd blame her for forcing me to go when I didn't want to go. Now that I'm old enough to go, I won't go. We'll have to see perhaps after she dies whether I go back to church or not. I don't know. Something mother thing here. But I went to work, and that's nothing unusual. Again, we were poor people. Okay? My wife's family had no money. If you didn't go get a job, you didn't live. I mean, you just, you know, I suppose I could have gone back home and sponged on my parents. We just never even considered that. So
that wasn't our ethic.
So I came back from the Army on November 30th, 1967 was my last day in the Army. And I reported for work December the 4th. I mean, 3 days, I was back to my old job at the Salem News.
Did you go back to the Salem News?
Yeah, and I felt bad about that, but I needed a job. Mm-hmm. So I booted they had to give my old job back, so they booted the kid that had taken my job. Mm-hmm. I worked there for about 3 months, and then I found another job. I always felt bad about that.
But you were entitled.
I was entitled, and I needed a job, and hey, you know. So my wife and I, we got an apartment, and we lived. We began a married life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other good things, I always say bad things about the Army, but one of the good things was we got to take R&R in Hawaii.
Did you really?
Which was nice. We never had the money to go back to Hawaii, and Lord knows when we will, but I was a 19-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid, and I flew from Vietnam into Hawaii. My wife flew from Ohio out, and we met, spent 5 or 6 days, wonderful, for the second honeymoon, and then flew back, which was very hard. It's better than being gone from, I didn't get to see her for a whole year, so. And we split that up nicely. It was about 6 months.
Was it?
It worked out real well.
That's wonderful.
So that was nice. And I suppose I have somebody to thank for that. It seemed like Alan Price to thank.
Yes.
So
wise. I agree. You adjusted well when you came back to your married life, and you
basically
went right back into the same routine.
I had no married life. We got married. I was gone know, we mm-hmm. went married a week and then mm-hmm. left, so.
No, so it was basically like newlyweds starting out.
Starting all over again. And we had some money in the bank, mm-hmm. which we had managed to save. So all in all, it wasn't a bad experience. I had no trauma. I had no nightmares. I do dream, though not as much lately. I used to dream a lot that I was back in Saigon, back in Vietnam, and trying to get home. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the dreams are strange because it's me here, 40-year-old, Harold Schramm back in Vietnam, looking for my old girlfriend's house or something, I don't know. Very strange. But I haven't had those dreams, they've faded. You know. But I used to dream a lot that I was back there. And I'd wake up, I was back there.
And trying to come home.
Trying to get, you know, waiting to come home.
That's interesting.
But, again, I had no traumatic experience. I saw no one hurt. I saw no one die. I wasn't certainly hurt. Nothing bad happened to me. You saw things. You heard things.
Was it an adjustment to come back to a small town after being in large cities, you know, and traveling?
I liked Saigon. Saigon was a beautiful city. When you got a day off, I enjoyed my days off. I would go downtown. You could walk downtown from where we were. I was a rich man.
I guess.
If I had 20 or 30 bucks in my pocket, I mean, there was nothing that I couldn't buy, you know. So we'd go, I'd go in a little French restaurant, I'd order something to drink. Mm-hmm. It was just wonderful. I mean, that part of it I liked. And I liked the Vietnamese people. I had taken a couple of years of high school French, so I could talk a little, we could converse.
In French?
In French, mm-hmm. and I'd learned as much Vietnamese as I could. I liked, you know, and they always enjoyed it. When you took the trouble to try to learn their language, I say, I got along very well with the Vietnamese people. You know.
The people that you were with in Saigon, you know, the military people, did you notice that they treated the Vietnamese with respect, or were they more rude and disrespectful to them?
Oh, terribly disrespectful. We used to, I used to tell the story, you pick up the paper, Stars and Stripes. VC terrorist attack, grenade thrown into a bar on Tudor Street. I used to laugh. I thought, then, they, you know, nobody knows what's really happened, but I got a pretty good idea what happened. Two GIs jumped in a Ciccolo or a cab and said, take us down to Tudor Street where all the whore, the prostitutes, the brothels, and the bars were. Okay. And when they got there, they stiffed the driver. They wouldn't pay. They just got out and so the guy, he just went down the street. It was very easy to get a grenade in a war country. And he just went back and threw a grenade in the place. There's no mystery here. There's no VC terrorist attack. Okay?
No war going on, so to speak.
I mean, you screw some guy over, he's going to get even. Mm-hmm. I can remember going downtown looking for something, shoe polish, mm-hmm. cigarette. All the stuff that we should have had in the PX wasn't there. It was all out on the black market, so you had to go buy it there. But I was walking along, and it's crowded as hell, and something's jabbing me in the back. And I turn around, and here's a Vietnamese soldier, Arvin. And he's got a whole thing of grenades hanging on his belt, and these grenades are jabbing me in the back, okay? Well, hell, I could have given this guy $5, and he'd have given me all the armament he had. He didn't care.
I mean, you could have gone and... Done the same thing.
I could have blown up my captain or my sergeant or anybody. So I'm saying it wasn't very difficult to get a hold of things. Okay? There were guys that did not smoke who bought their ration of cigarettes and then went down the black market and sold them. For an American greenback, this is another thing, they'll trust you. They took our money off of us and gave us military money, which wasn't worth a shit. But you take a $20 American greenback down to the black market, you could get perhaps $100 Vietnamese for it. Oh yeah, big time, you know. Like I say, women, drugs, booze, anything imaginable is available, you know, if you had money. I enjoyed that part. I took a lot of pictures.
Did you take a lot of pictures?
But again, I never went outside of Vietnam, and I always fault myself for that. You know, we got a Jeep one day and we were out riding around and we ran into an army roadblock, a Vietnamese army. And they couldn't speak English and we couldn't speak much Vietnamese. And we finally ended the conversation. They were pointing the way we were going in BC, and then they pointed the other way in Saigon, so we said, okay. And we turned around and went back.
Knew which way to go real quick.
That's right. But, you know, I got a chance to fly up north, Montagnards, where the Vietnamese Indians, if you will, we have the Aborigines, Americans. Well, the Montagnards are the indigenous people in Vietnam, lived up in the mountains. And this missionary chaplain organized a trip up there. We'd fly in a helicopter up to the mountains and visit this village. It was like 2 weeks before I scheduled to leave the country. And I checked it out. I said, no way in hell am I getting on that plane and flying up north. I'm just, you know.
And too close.
Well, it just, you know, I just wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Always took the safe course.
You're better off.
Well, sure. But now I got to carry around this horrible guilt load that I could have went up north and got my ass shot.
And then you wouldn't have to worry about being guilty anymore.
That's right.
Gee. Well, we've discussed your images at home and what you carried with you and how they changed when you came back, which was very little.
I think I changed only from the standpoint that I grew up. Okay.
You
I
noticed
left when
the difference
I was about
in
18,
your maturity?
19 years old. Well, I knew nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew nothing. I mean, and the Army will grow you up. Living in a foreign country will grow you up. Living on your own will grow you up. Going through a war will grow you up. So I think, yeah, I think a lot of things happened to me, but, you know, most of them good. Not all of them, but most of them good. So I grew up. That's really about the only thing that happened.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that I didn't cover? Is there anything that you thought I would ask you that I didn't?
No. I'm glad you had something to prompt, because I was afraid I wouldn't have anything to say, but I guess I shouldn't have worried about that.
You did great.
Oh.
You really did.
I don't know how I can express to someone listening to this years from now of how you felt. But it was my impression that I was middle American, and blue collar, poor white trash, I can call anything you want, but we were middle America, we'd grown up in the heartland, we went to church, we did what we were told, law-abiding, hard-working, you know, and we supported the war because we believed. We believed what they told us. Okay? And there for a while, it looked like we were the bums. And the heroes were the people who went to Canada and refused to serve. But they all came back. Okay? And whether it was an unjust war or not, I still think, you know, I did an honorable thing by doing what I was asked to do. And I wish to hell we had been in a more successful effort, because I think a lot of us are walking around beating up on ourselves because we lost. You know? But I don't have the answer to that. But this most recent events with Desert Storm, they honored the warrior, okay, and condemned the war, if you like, but at least you honor the warrior. And I wish someone had been smart enough to figure that out then. Because what we did, whether the war was just or unjust, right or wrong, we still did a hell of a job. I mean, 58,000 guys will never be able to say yes or no. And I suspect thousands since have died. Not so just a direct result of the war, but because of the war. Whether drinking, drugs, automobile accidents, ruined lives, I mean, the whole, and the price has been horrendous, and all the fucking praise in the world.
You've assimilated well. I mean, you've assimilated well in the respect that I can look at you as a co-worker and say, well, Harold came back and didn't drink himself to death like
somebody
Jim
else.
Did. And you came back and kept your home and your family and your wife, got a job, and here you are 20 years later doing a terrific
still
job.
Still functioning.
Yes.
I still function.
And
but again, I didn't suffer as much as the others, and that's why I say, to me, you know, when somebody says, Vietnam veteran, I want to say, yeah, that's me. But I know that I didn't, my sacrifice was small.
But the thing is, you still served, and you did what you had to do, and you did it commendably. And it still hurts that the world doesn't accept that, or the nation doesn't accept that, even after all this time. And I think that's commendable that, number one, that you did what you had to do. You came back and got on with your life. And it's also commendable that even after all these years, it still hurts.
The other thing I think unique, and this maybe is something they're going to do in future wars, and I don't know, but I went over to Vietnam alone as an individual. This one person. I didn't go with an outfit. I didn't go with my buddies. I didn't go with my comrades. I went over as an individual. And they assigned me to a replacement center, and I sat there until somebody grabbed me. And then I was integrated into a unit with a bunch of other strangers. Okay. And when I came home alone. And there were guys that I was serving with, you know, who had months yet to serve. So, the big thing there was how short are you? That is to say, how many days left in country. And of course, when you got there, you have 365 days. And when you get down to 50 days or something, well, I'm short. Oh, am I short? And that's all you talked about. You say, was how soon you could get back to the world. Okay. But that, I think, was part of the problem. You know, we went over as individuals, got assigned to a unit, hopefully became a part of that unit, but then you came back as an individual. And I don't know how or what they could change, but I think, you know, of course, Desert Storm was easy. They sent whole units over, whole units came back. And these guys were all professional soldiers, too. They joined. We got drafted, you know. And quite frankly, I think the Army treated us with somewhat contempt, too.
But there is an aloneness factor there.
That's
there
right.
Is.
I went over alone and came back alone. And like I say, there was no band playing to welcome me home. And it wouldn't have been practical either. I mean, there was no way to welcome you home. So your mother and your father and your girl were there, and that's it. And that's all was there to see me off. And they were there to welcome me home. And that's and apparently that's as good as it's going to be. And I took solace fact that I didn't bug out, I didn't run and hide, I did what they asked me to do, and very undistinguished.
Life goes on, but it still was important, and that's the sad part that wasn't recognized.
And I suspect that I'm not unusual.
No, you're not, Harold.
They used to say, and I don't know if it's true, but it took 10 men in the rear echelon, to keep one guy out in the field. In your frontline combat, you know, at any one time, there might have been half a million people there, but I don't think there was ever more than 50, 60,000 guys in the field. So I would suppose I am the typical Vietnam vet in that, you know, most of them were not heavy combat veterans. Yeah.
That's true.
But
I know the ones that I've interviewed haven't been.
Cool.
And the ones that I have set up, you know, after you haven't been. You know, this is the norm. And this is what most people don't realize.
Yeah, the public image of the Vietnam vet is some crazed killer, you know. But most of them are not. Most of them are just ordinary people doing ordinary type jobs.
That's true.
Well,
thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
And it was a very interesting interview. You don't think so, but I do.